Hello, everybody. Welcome to You, Me, Them, Everybody. My name is Brandon Weatherby, and I am speaking with one of the founders of Homeroom Chicago, Seth Vanek. Seth is the curator for the Homeroom 101 lecture series that we have at the Hungry Brain. And I want to talk to Seth before this episode so you, dear listener, will have something to look forward to or know what the hell's about to happen. So, Seth.
Yes.
What is about to happen?
Well, we're about to listen. Well, we'll probably not listen to it ourselves, but we're about to present the a recording from our lecture series 101. It was our February installment about hobos and tramps.
Okay. What is the 101? Like when you said the 101 installment, what exactly is the 101 series?
Well, I should be, before I say that, I should be clear that I'm not the only curator of 101. I also do it with a fellow named Fred Sasaki, who deserves a lot of the credit for this particular installment of the series. The idea behind 101 is that it's like a lecture series, like a really low-rent, more drunk sort of TED Talks, except instead of talking about the new world economy or using microchips to advertise to people more efficiently, we're talking about underground comics or hobos or horror movies or you know, nerdy music or just things that people might be interested in but never would really go to the trouble of learning about unless they could sit in a bar and drink a beer and have it presented to them in a fun, easy, casual way. So that's sort of the idea of it. It's a, you know, a lecture series that's not as pretentious as a lecture series sounds when you just say lecture series.
That's good that you added the "not as pretentious as it sounds." So this one is about hobos.
Yes.
Whose idea was it to do a lecture series about hobos? And is it weird?
It is. I think it is weird. I was amazed at how much enthusiasm there was for learning about hobos at this day and age. There's a fellow named Paul DeRica who's a really smart guy who's getting a PhD at University of Chicago. He's a writer.
Wait a second. What is he getting his PhD in?
I think it's actually just in writing.
Okay.
But he's kind of also a historian, like an amateur historian. For a while, he's been doing these like walking tours of Chicago. Like he's really interested in the history of Chicago. So cool. he'll do like a walking tour of like the Leopold and Loeb murder case, and he'll
fantastic.
Go to like relevant places. And he's really engaging. In fact, he just did this great thing a couple weeks ago where it was like a reenactment of this hunger strike from like the early, you know, like the early part of last century, where it was like Hull House. It was based around Hull House. Anyway, it's really fun, and he gets people to dress up and do these like historical reenactments, and it's pretty great. So he has this interest in hobo culture, and he's done a lot of reading and writing about it, and he's done like little versions of this talk in other places, and this was kind of the culmination of it. He had all these images collected and music, and he has met a bunch of like actual you know, men who like ride freight trains and sort of move from town to town, and so he was able to put together a really nice presentation that would really, any question I could possibly have about hobos was answered, I can honestly say.
So this show, this upcoming show this show that they're listening to, is,
yeah,
you have to, do you have to be interested in hobo culture to enjoy this?
I wouldn't say so. I think that you'll learn, you know, all you have to be interested in is just cool stuff. I mean, it's, you know, the thing about hobos is that there's a lot to relate to. It's like a resourceful community of people that are not, you know, plugged into society. They have their own kind of system of communication and their own sort of institutions. A lot of the lectures about this institution called the Hobo College, which happened in Chicago, where a lot of hobos got together with the help of a couple benefactors and actually had like a legitimate school where they could like read Shakespeare, but then also like trade secrets about where to, you know, how to get a day job in you know, Albuquerque or whatever. So it's you know, I think it's fairly interesting stuff. And like I said, Paul is a pretty engaging speaker. The show is from it was on February 8th, and we had two speakers. The first act, which is not in the podcast, was Tony Fitzpatrick, who's this great artist and actor and poet, and he did like a really cool short presentation on sort of this hobo code that Paul talks about, where they would leave these little chalk drawings that says, mm-hmm, whether a town is friendly to hobos or not. So
if you've seen the Mad Men episodes where Don Draper has flashbacks to his childhood, you'll see the hobo episode, and the code is actually in that. So that's a
no kidding.
What's up?
That's awesome. I never knew that. I gotta go watch.
Don Draper in Mad Men is from the Midwest, from the Dust Bowl area, and they go through the code, actually. So that's a good primer for this episode. And also, obviously, O Brother, Where Art Thou covers this somewhat. And just so you know, we're not romanticizing homelessness.
Yes.
This is different.
Yeah. Right. I think this is and I think Paul in the podcast, you'll hear him. You know, he'll kind of distinguish between a hobo and a tramp and a bum, and they're not the same thing. Homelessness is a thing, but this is a certain mode of life that, is fairly respectable. And I think that Paul makes a good case for it.
Okay.
But of course, you know, the listeners will have to be the judge.
Ooh, you're fair and diplomatic. So we got to we have to thank Fred for putting this event together along with yourself.
Okay.
We got to thank our speakers, Paul. We got to thank Tony, who is also on the show. And didn't the show end with a musical performance that's not recorded?
Yeah, we had a really good songwriter named Dave Dondero, who has been in the music business for a really long time. He played a really great set of amazing songs. And he's worth looking up. It's Dave, Dondero.
And obviously, thank the Hungry Brain. And Homeroom is at the Hungry Brain the second Tuesday of every month.
Right.
But you're also at other places. You do other events. What are those events?
Well, we do a series at Elastic in Logan Square in Chicago about songs and songwriting, where we get some of our favorite songwriters to play their songs without their backup bands or without any kind of bells and whistles.
So it's like a VH1 Storytellers type of event.
Precisely. But it's, you know, it's pretty fun. And this semester we got a lot of different Chicago people to curate it. So Saki Record Store is doing one.
Oh, that's great. Trip
Radio is doing one. Coach House Sounds is doing one. So that's a lot of fun. And then we're always doing a lot of other different projects. But people can go to homeroomchicago.org and learn all about that stuff.
So homeroomchicago.org. Thanks for listening. Thanks for Seth and I. And here is Hobo College. What should we call this? Hobo 101, Hobo College. What's the official title, Seth?
I think they called it Hobo 101, The Return of the Hobo College.
Fantastic. Without further ado, here's Hobo 101, The Return of the Hobo College.
All right. So the Hobo College Hungry Brain Edition is currently in session. I should tell you that this is an interactive part of tonight's program. So if at any point you've got a question or you want to shout something out or just want to like share your two cents, please feel free to do so. I'm under no obligation to actually answer your question, but feel free to voice it. But I will do my best and try not to trip on this cord. All right. So, it's an Irish hobo. It's true. The Irish character. Actually, one of the very... What?
It was all in good fun.
That's true. One of the very first times that a tramp appeared in American fiction was actually a Bret Hart story called My Friend the Tramp. And this is from 1878. And it's like not hard to notice that the tramp speaks in a very kind of pronounced Irish brogue throughout it. Although this was a misconception, because as like later sociologists would discover, most tramps were actually like native-born Americans, often for several generations, like Josiah Flint, who grew up in Evanston, Illinois, and whose aunt was the head of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. I'm already digressing, and I'm only like a minute into this thing. All right, so here you have a lithograph called the New Constitution from 1879. The actual inscription at the bottom says, "Tramp, tramp, tramp, the tramp is coming." You know, itinerants and like vagrants predate the Civil War, but it really wasn't until after the Civil War that a new word basically kind of entered our language. Now, this word had previously been used as a verb to describe a type of sort of meandering or wandering, but starting in the 1870s, it started being used as a noun to describe a particular type of person, and that word is tramp. Prior to the early 1870s, you really don't see tramp being used to describe vagrants or itinerants. And the reason why this was is because, like, after the Civil War, there was a whole sort of cycle of, like, economic depressions and recessions, which threw tons of people out of work. And so suddenly there were all these people kind of wandering the country. There were also a lot of Civil War veterans who never had properly kind of adjusted to life after wartime. And after 1868, we had a transcontinental railway, which basically connected the East and the West Coast. And suddenly there was this whole new system of transportation that people could steal rides on and get from one place to the other. It was also a little known fact that in the 1870s, tramps were 136 feet tall. No wonder they were such a terror to the countryside. You can see a little farmer there, there's the pig running, and a goose, I think, and a duck, and a child. But this image actually reflects what was sort of a kind of very prevalent view in the 1870s, right? Which is that the tramp, or the hobo, or the bum, is a kind of sort of social parasite, kind of living on the labor of others. And particularly rural communities were kind of frightened about the appearance of these individuals. And if you read the newspapers from the time, particularly the world's greatest newspaper, you'll find all sorts of articles about tramps, you know, setting fire to barns, or tramps stealing pies, or tramps, like, harassing the farmer's wife. You'll also find an article that the Tribune editors produced in which they suggest putting strychnine in the food that farmers give to tramps as a way of reducing the unemployment problem. But, now this article turns up in every history written about tramps, like Hard Traveling by Kenneth Alsop, which came out in 68, all the way through Citizen Hobo by Todd DePesquino, which came out in 2003. But every historian always omits the second part of the Tribune article involving the strychnine, in which you discover it's actually a criticism of the government in Springfield. Because in the 1870s, various state governments started passing anti-tramp and anti-vagrancy laws, basically making it a crime to be a tramp or a hobo. And the article in the Tribune is critical of Springfield for not producing a strong enough law or one that could actually be enforced efficiently. So that's why they tell the farmer to put the strychnine in the food. Okay, second slide, please, Seattle Red. So at the same time that there was this very negative image of the tramp and the hobo and bum cropping up among the crops, there was also this kind of other version, right? So very quickly the tramp becomes a kind of stock character in both like comic strips and sort of American humor. And so here you can see an old vaudeville show poster, a startling melodrama, A Ragged Hero, right? In which case the tramp or hobo character is, well, a ragged hero. Now, when I tell you a little bit later on about the true story behind the Big Rock Candy Mountain, you might question this image a little bit. But it's important to know that, like, when I'm talking about tramps and hobos and bums, I'm always kind of talking about two types of people. The actual historical people who rode the rails, who were unemployed, who begged for food and clothes, or sometimes worked odd jobs. And then these kind of representations in popular culture. I mean, it's really interesting that the American public kind of have a sort of like split view, right? Actual homeless people, they distrusted, they sort of criminalized, but then they made these sort of romantic and kind of heroic characters in their sort of popular culture. And then, emerging out of this sort of romantic tramp, of course, is the comic tramp. Charlie Chaplin is by far the most comic tramp, but comic tramps began appearing as early as the late 19th century. Any like experts in trampology out there? Can they tell me who? What? It's not actually. That's a good guess. That's not Evan Smith either, but that would be pretty great. Any other guesses?
Is it Red Skeleton?
It's Red Skeleton.
Imitating Emmett Kelly.
Imitating Emmett Kelly, yes. It's Red Skeleton and his popular character, Freddy the Freeloader. Red Skeleton was a popular TV comic from the 50s. I'm glad some people still remember it. There's actually a bridge named after Red Skeleton connecting Illinois and Indiana.
Skeleton.
Was I saying skeleton?
Yeah.
I must have been having like Masters of the Universe flashbacks. All right. Oh, okay. Next slide. So, you know, you've got this like criminalized social parasite, hobo, tramp. You know, no one has yet asked me what the difference is between a tramp, a hobo, and a bum.
What's the difference between a tramp, a hobo, and a bum?
I'm glad you asked. Because a big part of this talk will be kind of hinged on this difference. So, in the late 19th century, so sort of post-Civil War up till around the early 1900s, most people, including this gentleman here, Jack London, used the words kind of interchangeably. But then in the early 1900s, you see a kind of distinctions being made, right? So, a hobo is somebody who works and wanders, right? So a hobo is basically what would today be kind of migrant laborer. And hobos are very kind of proud of this sort of distinction. They did not want to be mistaken as being a tramp, Because a tramp is somebody who dreams and wanders, right? So he's that like flaky friend of yours who never has any cash on him and is always catching for a drink. Couch surfing, stuff like that. And then finally, a bum is someone who drinks and doesn't wander. And we probably all know one or two of those. So, sorry about that. So, this gentleman here, Jack London, was one of the people responsible for sort of rehabilitating the sort of image of the tramp. Now, London himself, he was born in Oakland, and in his early years, he actually went on the road himself. He went twice for a brief journey and then a longer journey in 1894, where he actually joined up with Coxey's Army, which was this sort of like army of unemployed people. He was actually part of Kelly's Army, which was the West Coast branch. 1894 was coming on the heels of a huge kind of economic dip, known as the Panic of 1893, in which basically 25 million, I think it was 25 million people were like out of work as a result of the economic crisis which had developed. Keep in mind, the United States population at this time was only around 63 million. So it's almost like a third of the population was out of work. A young Jack London had read the Josiah Flynt's articles on tramping, which appeared in Harper's and Century Atlantic, and he decided he was going to take to the road and write his own stuff. So he joined up with this huge hobo army that was going to Washington to demand from the president public works programs. By the time the hobos actually made it to Washington, and Jacob Coxey, who was leading the army, Jacob Coxey was not a hobo or a tramp. He actually owned a rock crushing business from Massillon. He was from Massillon, Ohio, where it was. He also had a son named Legal Tender, and was called a general, even though he was not a general, Jacob Coxey. He named his son Legal Tender because he was so devoted to monetary reform. So he and Legal Tender and his wife traveled from Massillon, Ohio, all the way to Washington, D.C., with this huge army of tramps and hobos and other unemployed people to petition President Grover Cleveland for jobs, and then were promptly arrested for trespassing when they stepped on the lawn of the Capitol building. But Coxey made his point, and eventually, during FDR and the New Deal, public works programs would be enacted. But anyhow, back to Jack London. So Jack London wrote about his experiences on the road. For a long time, they weren't published because nobody knew who he was, but then he wrote The Call of the Wild, he became famous, and he also, like a lot of writers, ended up signing multiple contracts for things that he couldn't fulfill. So he was going to take a voyage around the world, and he promised various magazines exclusive rights to his account of this voyage. They found out about this, and so with one of the magazines, Cosmopolitan, not the Cosmopolitan that exists today and gets you tips on your love life, but a very different magazine, he agreed to write about his tramping experiences, and he wrote a series of 9 essays that were later collected in a book called The Road. But London was always fascinated by tramps and hobos and bums, and if you go to the Huntington Library in Pasadena, California, you'll find all of his papers. And like a lot of people in that era, he was kind of a scrapbook nut. So he'd clip things out of newspapers and create little files and save them. And so if you look at the file marked hobo, you'll find a certain article from 1911 that concerns something that occurred at the University of Missouri, Columbia. Do we have any Missouri natives, St. Louis people here? Okay, so this article is from 1911. It basically is about what was the second annual hobo ball. So all of the fraternities at the University of Missouri, the fraternity guys would basically dress up as hobos, take a train to the outskirts of town, outskirts of Columbia, and then basically panhandle their way back to the university. Whatever they got, whether it was food or clothing or whatever, they would collectively share, and then the sorority sisters would make a big meal of it. Now, what's even stranger about this event of a bunch of college boys dressing up as hobos in 1911, stealing food or whatever, is that mixed in with them were genuine men of the road, knights of the road. Because also in Missouri, an organization had developed called the International Brotherhood Welfare Association, led by a man named James Eads Howe, a.k.a. the Millionaire Hobo. So at the Hobo Ball of 1911, you would have these college guys dressed as hobos and tramps, probably very much in the kind of Red Skelton mode, and then you'd have actual hobos and tramps kind of hanging out with them, and probably getting a meal and some free drinks out of it. So you can see how these two different kind of representations would often kind of overlap with each other. Next image. This is a photograph from Jack London's essays, The Road. There's a great essay called Holding Them Down, which is all about just catching trains. So if you ever want to know how to catch a train in the early 1900s, be sure to this essay. It's not actually very practical by today's standards. It's very cutting edge. His publishers had a series of like photographs that accompanied the essays. This is not Jack London, even though the caption says Jack London. It's actually a Jack London lookalike. Just keep in mind, he was going on that voyage around the world, so he couldn't be there to pose for photographs. Plus, Jack London would probably not catch a train wearing a straw boater. But that's just my guess. But that is one way of catching a train, not very practical, which is riding on the top of a passenger car, which you can see there. You know, even though you have this kind of like image of the hobo and tramp and bum as a kind of social parasite and problem, and you have either this kind of romanticized or highly comic version of the tramp, there are still actual real like unemployed people using the railway system to travel across the country. Next slide. And this is an image of one of those people. So there was a modern language professor and minister named John J. McCook, who wrote a whole series of articles about tramps and actually paid tramps to like pose in photographs. And so this is a guy showing how you would ride under a train. Jack London.
Fly rod.
What?
Fly rod.
So, so, I mean, this is actually riding, you know, the rods underneath it. It's a very dangerous way to kind of ride the rails, and only the sort of hardiest sort of people would decide to do it. You're always kind of at the risk of injury, not only from the train wheels throwing stuff up, but like the brakemen who would be on the trains, or sometimes the conductors, would kind of rig the cars in such a way they'd have kind of a metal cord and a spike so that they would like pull it up, and if they knew somebody was riding under the trains, it'd start like bouncing up and down. Basically, they kind of cut the hobo into ribbons. But as I said, this is a kind of more accurate representation of the sort of person that you would encounter. Now, hobo labor was very important to building the infrastructure of this country. The infrastructure of this country, one could probably say charitably, is in a state of decline. But without the kind of migrant labor force, without the hobos, you know, our forests would not have been cleared, our roads would not have been built, our bridges would not have been built. Hobo labor did a lot of this sort of stuff. Same with agricultural labor as well. People used to have to cut ice back in the day before we had refrigerators, ship the ice to cities, keep things cool in the summer. It was almost all transient labor that did this. And so it would have been men like the one that we see pictured here. A lot of them, though, ended up in Chicago. Chicago was kind of the sort of hobo capital of the world. This is a map from John Drury's 1928 Guide to the City called Chicago in 7 Days. And you can see the ways in which certain neighborhoods are marked. So this Little Italy is basically kind of where Little Italy is today, although in a condensed form. But north of it, you can see kind of on Halsted, like east of Halsted, there's an area called Flop Town. And that's where there would have been like a bunch of kind of like low-income housing. In particular, like flop houses, missions, places like that, charity housing, what we later call single residency hotels. And then to the west, you see the Red Belt, and it's called that because there were a lot of like labor unions that were also based in this area, which gradually developed the name kind of Hobohemia. So Hobohemia, and particularly Madison Street, west from Wells, all the way to Union Park, was like populated by anywhere from 30,000 in the summer to 75,000 in times of economic crisis, 100,000 homeless men would live in this sort of small area around West Madison Street. There'd be cheap lodging houses there, there'd be cheap bars, cheap restaurants, there would be things like the Radical Bookstore, and also like institutions like the Hobo College, which is primarily what I'm going to be talking about today. And you can also see some of the other labor row, some of the other areas. Why did people come to Chicago? Well, there was a guy in 1923, a sociologist from the University of Chicago, who wrote a book called The Hobo, and in it he relates the fact that in the city of Chicago, there were 2,840 miles of railroad just within the city limits itself. Chicago was the railroad center of the country, and if you're a culture that primarily you know, uses the railway system to get from one point to the other, it makes sense that you would congregate in the sort of central node. As I said, the population would balloon in the winter because most of these people were migrant laborers and they would head west or south during the warmer months, but they'd come back to Chicago for the winter months. And so,
What is Commission Row?
Commission Row? Basically, like, kind of wholesale sort of stuff, things like that. There are a lot of, like, wholesale grocers, things like that. As you can see, almost none of that is still there. Like, there's a kind of, like, specter of Greek town that still exists, right? And Little Italy was largely kind of removed by UIC. Full Market is
still there.
Full Market is still there, that's true. Yeah.
What was the Oprah's?
What? Oprah is still there, that's true. We do have Oprah.
Thank God.
What was the ghetto?
What is what?
The ghetto.
The ghetto? Oh, that's the Jewish neighborhood. Yeah.
Maxwell Street,
basically. And Roosevelt Road as well. I'm certain there's many Manny's fans.
It's still
there,
referred
right?
to as Jewtown by some people.
It is referred to as Jewtown by some people. That is true. Yes, you do hear that from time to time. Okay, so, next slide. Yes.
Where's the word hobo come from?
That's a good question. Depends on who you ask. It's one of those words you don't really start seeing appearing until the 1890s, and some people say that it's a corruption of a hoboy, so like a kind of farm laborer who uses a hoe. Doesn't sound very right. Other, like, more refined gentlemen say that it's actually, like, a corruption of the French hot beau, as my French is terrible. Is that good? I don't know. Meaning, like, a hot beau. All right, thank you. Meaning, like, a sort of fine gentleman. But there is no real kind of, like, exact answer to that question. The term just starts getting used in the 1890s. Different people give different reasons for why they use it. And as I said, you'll often see it used interchangeably with tramp. Up until about the early 1900s, when tramps and hobos really began to kind of distinguish themselves from each other. Turf war. Okay.
Homeward bound.
What?
Homeward bound.
Homeward bound is another, yeah, that's right. I mean, there's like six or seven different, like, you know, origins of the word hobo. This is an image taken of the interior of the most infamous flop house on West Madison Street. It was known as Hogan's Flop. Like, a lot of these places have kind of traveled around the city from season to season. It was never located in one place, but people would always find it. The proprietor is in the right-hand corner. His name was Ben Hogan. He was an ex-boxer and also a gun runner during the Civil War. He supplied both the Union and the Confederacy with guns. And then, after he retired from the boxing ring, he opened a cheap lodging house where anywhere from 5 to 10 cents would basically buy you a space on the floor to sleep at night. That's all basically that you were getting. And that's most of like what a lot of the sort of institutions around West Madison Street were like if they weren't kind of official charities. There was also a place called the Rufus Dawes House, which was named after the drowned son of Charles Gates Dawes, who was Calvin Coolidge's vice president. Calvin Coolidge, our earliest president. But as you can see, a lot of these things were either for-profit kind of operations like Hogan's or very sort of charitable organizations. And in the early 1900s, you start seeing kind of hobos and tramps sort of organizing among themselves and creating their own sort of spaces and institutions. And chief among these was the Hobo College. So next slide. So this is an image of James Eads Howe, the hobo millionaire, addressing a group of hobos and tramps. Howe, as I said, was from St. Louis. He was the grandson of a man by the name of James Buchanan Eads. And if you're thinking, was he named after James Buchanan, the president? Yes, because his mother was James Buchanan's cousin. James Buchanan Eads designed the Eads Bridge, which still exists in Chicago today and was the first bridge, and still exists today and was the first bridge to cross the Mississippi. Eads inherited significant money both from his maternal grandfather and from his own father, who was the head of the Wabash Railroad, but he decided that what he was going to do is he was going to give it all away. He went to Harvard, but didn't finish. He went to Oxford, but didn't quite finish. He studied medicine, never became a doctor, but he did become friends in England with George Bernard Shaw and a vegetarian, which for the early 1900s was a pretty wacky thing to be. He also decided that he was going to devote his life to this organization he founded called the International Brotherhood Welfare Association. And basically what it would attempt to do is kind of organize migrant laborers. And it would create kind of like clearing centers and clinics and employment stations for them across the country. It put out a publication called the Hobo News, where hobos could read about other hobos and kind of see what was going on in the country. And it also produced a kind of nomadic institution of higher learning called the Hobo College. Now, there were hobo colleges across the country, but by far the largest and most respected was the one in Chicago because it was the hobo capital. One last thing about Howe. He eventually died basically of pneumonia and malnutrition and then starvation. He led a very kind of Spartan life. He always kind of dressed very kind of plainly. As I said, he was a vegetarian, but he didn't even eat all that much. Keep in mind, this early 1900s, not many vegetarian items on the menu. So unfortunately for James, he ended up starving to death. But he also was the person who basically bankrolled this whole kind of hobo college empire that we're going to learn about tonight. So next slide. So around 1907, this gentleman turns up in St. Louis. His name is Ben Lewis Reitman. He's from Milwaukee originally, but moves to Chicago at an early age, somehow manages, despite his very working class background, to acquire a medical degree, tramps and hobos all across the country, and then decides that he's going to devote his life to the downtrodden. He meets up with Howe in St. Louis, likes what Howe is doing, says he's going to come to Chicago and open a hobo college there. This is an article from 1907 that appeared in the Tribune, and one thing that made Reitman really interesting is he was sort of a publicity agent and a sort of performance artist before publicity agents and performance artists really existed. So he knew how to draw attention to Howe's operation in a way that Howe could never imagine or never sort of knew about. So the first thing that Reitman did when he returned to Chicago is he decided that he was going to go undercover and investigate all the charitable organizations in the city. Even places like Hull House, right, which were really well respected. And he posed as a kind of out-of-work man, as a tramp, and asked them either for food or employment. A lot of these places rebuffed him, a lot of them treated him very poorly, a lot of them forced him to, like, you know, fumigate his clothes, right, to get all the vermin out of them and so forth. And so then, of course, he took all of this information to the newspapers, and the newspapers had a field day, kind of publicizing how cold the heart of Chicago's charitable institutions was. And this became a perfect opening then for Reitman to say, hey, we've got this new thing, the International Brotherhood Welfare Association, we're going to open this hobo college. Hobos are actually going to kind of organize and then sort of like shift for themselves. So it was like a really kind of good and sort of interesting kind of strategy and then sort of brilliant in its way. Next slide. So this is an image, I just thought this was kind of interesting. You're like, well, why would people care reading about tramps or hobos or bums? And this is from the Chicago Tribune, around the same era, late 19-teens, and there was actually like a workers' magazine that appeared every Sunday. So try to imagine the Chicago Tribune in this day and age having a workers' magazine. But you could see at least there was a sort of interest for that sort of material. So next thing. So after Reitman, you know, does his little undercover work in 1907, he pulls his next stunt, basically laying the foundation for the Hobo College. And so he goes to the Windsor Clifton Hotel, as you can tell, one of the most elegant hotels in the city. And using James Eads Howe, the hobo millionaire's money, he books this giant banquet room, right? So he's going to have a huge banquet here for the Hobo College, but not going to be just any sort of banquet. Next piece. No. It's going to be a hobo banquet. So this article comes from the New York Times, and you can see bums to speak at odd banquet. It pretty much tells you everything you need to know. Part of uplift scheme. That's really great. So in 1908, the Windsor Clifton Hotel, which is a very kind of like respectable, luxurious hotel, Loop Hotel, Ben Reitman had this famous hobo's banquet. Hobos from all across the country turned up in order to give speeches and toasts. One of the people present there was A. Number One, who would later write a series of books, including some about his travels with Jack London. And it became this huge kind of public relations event. It appeared in newspapers all across the country. And in some ways, Reitman was kind of like, you know, playing upon sort of popular conceptions of the hobo as this kind of comic character. But on the other hand, he also got the message of the International Brotherhood Welfare Association across and the Hobo College and drew all this attention to it. All this attention from artists and intellectuals and various academics would later turn up on the faculty of the institution. So next piece. So the very next year, the Hobo College opens in Chicago. Now the Hobo College would change every season, right? It would only be open during the winter months, so it would often only offer courses for about 3 months of the year. But you could take courses there basically for free in like law, economics, biology, first aid. A lot of it was very kind of practical information for sort of migrant laborers. But there was, 1908 is when the Hobo College opens in Chicago. And it basically will stay open until through the early 1920s. But every year it'll be in a different location. So Hal would put forth the money to rent a new building. And so there was a Hobo College at like 917 West Washington Street. There was another Hobo College at like 1118 West Madison Street, which later became the headquarters of the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World. So the Hobo College would have basically a three-month, like, it would be open for about 3 months. Usually anywhere from like 150 to 200 people would take classes there. There would also be some space for people to sleep, some place for people to like cook meals. There was always a guy often there by the name of Dad Crouch, who was a one-legged former train hopper. He had lost his leg due to an injury, but he was always there to greet people. But the fascinating thing about the Hobo College is it not only attracted hobos, it also attracted like very respectable academics. So professors from the University of Chicago and Northwestern, also various local kind of public figures, lawyers, would give courses at the Hobo College. So a guy like Herman Adler, who was like a very early kind of, you know, expert on psychoanalysis, gave a class at the Hobo College. Or, we can go to that. Oh, by the way, so Reitman, you know, is involved early on, but then in 1910 he meets this fetching lady right here, Emma Goldman. He takes off on basically a kind of 10-year jaunt, kind of helping her kind of spread her sort of message of anarchism and birth control and free love all across the country. So around like 1910, Reitman kind of leaves the scene, but the Hobo College continues on without him, although he will return to Chicago. So, next image. This is a very faded image of E.W. Burgess. They actually snapped an 8x10 that hangs in the Department of Sociology at the University of Chicago. So E.W. Burgess taught sociology at the University of Chicago, but he also taught classes at the Hobo College as well. So it gives you a sense of the sort of caliber of people that Reitman was able to bring in and kind of involve in this sort of operation. The first time that Burgess went to the Hobo College, though, he and his partner in the Department of Sociology, Robert Park, went incognito. They basically dressed up as tramps because they wanted to do sort of sociological field work. This was about 1922. They were quickly found out and exposed, but they made a deal with the members of the Hobo College, which is that the members of the Hobo College could write their own sort of autobiographies, and then Burgess and Park would take these autobiographies and use them kind of as sociological data. So all the hobos are invited to write their life stories, and a faculty exchange occurred. So Chicago Whitey was going to go down to Hyde Park and talk literally about vermin that infested boarding houses. And a man by the name of Mike Smith was also going to go down to Hyde Park as well and talk about the unemployment problem, which, being a migrant laborer, he knew quite a bit about. So a little faculty exchange occurred. So, as I said, a lot of the curriculum at the Hobo College was fairly pragmatic. Hobos would take classes on law, sociology, political science, economy, history, first aid. There would be a lot of emphasis on like practical things, like how to distinguish panhandling from mooching, or what the various vagrancy laws were in different states. Here's an image of Mary Riley, who taught first aid at the Hobo College, but who also taught an English composition course. And the reason why I show this image is because there was also a real kind of interest in the arts at the Hobo College. So there were all these kind of practical classes, but there was this whole other part of the curriculum that was focused on producing kind of well-rounded individuals. The hobos actually had access to their own gymnasium. The Cathedral of St. Peter's and St. Paul let the Hobo College use their gymnasium. There's a newspaper article about like hobos doing like jujitsu. And apparently they learned like on the West Coast, laboring alongside like Japanese residents of like California. This is what the Tribune says. They were doing jujitsu. I don't know. That's right. So Mary Riley, though, you know, taught these classes on literature as well. There was also a famous tramp writer by the name of Jim Tolley. He wrote an autobiographical novel called Beggars of Life, who would sometimes teach at the Hobo College. And he would later become a press agent for Charlie Chaplin, and wrote the first sort of like unauthorized biography of Charlie Chaplin. So, as I said, the Hobo College was a nomadic institution. Every year would be in a different part of Chicago, but it would always have certain things that would carry along with it. One would be a well-stocked library that would have such classics as totemism and exogamy, which we all, of course, have read, Darwin and After Darwin, pretty much all the novels of Jack London. There was also something called the like Encyclopedia Hoboania, which basically, there was this poet by the name of A.W. W. Dragstead, who hung out at Hobo College, and he basically collected every single sort of newspaper article, magazine article, whatever sort of reference to hobos and trams, and kept it in this giant encyclopedia. So every time the Hobo College changed location, it would bring this library with it. And it would also bring the following oil portraits of various famous tramps. So, Erasmus.
Yeah, baby.
There was always a portrait of Erasmus. Next one. Voltaire.
What?
Yes, there was always a portrait of Voltaire. Continue. sorry. Darwin.
Yeah.
Keep going. Darwin and After Darwin. Very popular. Walt Whitman.
Yeah.
Portrait of Walt Whitman.
Why did they like Darwin?
They just liked Darwin because they were really into like science classes.
They hated religion.
And they hate religion too. Well, that could be part of it.
No, because Darwin would have been seen as the antidote to the evangelical Christianity that demanded they sit and pray for 6 hours before they could have a meal.
That's true.
Darwin
That's a good point.
Was the rational,
yeah.
Modern.
And keep in mind, they're like probably also like Herbert Spencer was very popular as well. And there's like a hobo that was interviewed by the Tribune, and they asked him about his reading habits. And he said, you know, I like Shakespeare, Hawthorne, and Ibsen, which seems like such a weird combination. But then he said, like, you know, I also, like, really, like, read Marx, and I think pragmatism is actually the end of all philosophy. And I think I actually got that quote right, or that quotation right. That's more or less what the guy said. So it's Walt Whitman. Mark Twain.
What?
Yeah.
And lastly, portrait of Jack London as well. And so these oil portraits would travel from location to location with the Hobo College and always have a sort of place of honor in them. So next slide. Thanks, yeah, right? So this is a picture of Mike Walsh, who was one of the people who took over after Ben Reitman went off gallivanting with Emma Goldman. And Walsh was, influential and bringing various kind of prominent cultural figures to perform at the Hobo College. Chief among these was a woman by the name of Mary Garden. Mary Garden was kind of like the sort of Sarah Bernhardt of opera, if that reference makes any sense.
Yes.
If I don't know that. All right, I hope it does. I'm about to suggest, okay. So Mary Garden was sort of the premier opera singer of her era. She actually was involved with the Chicago Opera, and she was invited to come and perform a concert at the Hobo College, which she graciously agreed to do. And what we're going to do right now is hear an actual clip of Mary Garden singing, so you'll have a sense of what those hobos heard back on that night in March in 1917. Building, and this woman's sitting here singing to a group of 150 or so transient men. Something along these lines. Not actually the Debussy, but she sings some of her stuff. After the concert, a gray-haired old hobo approached her and shook her hand and said some things in Latin, and then told her it was, like, by the gods, the finest thing he had ever heard. Mary was so touched by this, and so was the best compliment that she'd received all season. She agreed to come back and play at the Hobo College a second time, and she actually donated a piano to the college that cost a couple of $1,000s. The next winter, the hobos cut up the piano to use it as firewood.
But, you know,
cool! This is Chicago! Think about like, what it's like outside right now, right?
Right?
Piano,
right?
Stay warm. All right. So, you might be asking, like, what happened to the Hobo College? Well, as I said, you know, it started in the early 1900s, it was very successful throughout the 19-teens, and then the 1920s, it kind of enters a sort of period of decline. And in my theory, at least about it, is it becomes kind of, like, taken over by different sorts of, like, groups or institutions. So I've been using the term hobohemia occasionally, which kind of gestures towards a sort of blending of, like, hobo culture and kind of bohemian arts culture. And you really start to kind of see that in the 19-teens and 20s in Chicago, and in a particular space. And this is the Dill Pickle Club. The Dill Pickle Club was located... Some of you have heard of the Dill Pickle Club. It was located near the Newberry Library, off an alley off of Washington Park, which was known as Bughouse Square. And it was a free speech area in the city of Chicago, basically the kind of Hyde Park of Chicago. I'm not talking about Hyde Park down the south, but you know, Hyde Park in London. Where basically anybody could kind of like hold forth on whatever topic was passionate for them. And the story goes that the Dill Pickle Club developed in part so that the soapbox speakers would have someplace to go in the winter. But like the Hobo College before it, and Ben Reitman was also involved in Dill Pickle Club, they attracted all sorts of like academics and artists and people like that. So writers like Ben Hecht and Sherwood Anderson, Carl Sandburg would show up at the Dill Pickle Club. People like Clarence Darrow would be there, but also like, you know, Burgess and Park from the University of Chicago, and even like a Nobel Prize winning physicist like Albert Michelson gave a talk there. But he might be followed by Mae West, right? Talking about her show Sex,
yes!
Which was like being performed in the city at that time. So it was a very eclectic sort of like format in terms of who was presenting. It was kind of a public forum, but they would also put on plays. It's the first time Eugene O'Neill was performed in the city of Chicago.
Hey.
It was at the Dill Pickle Club. They also had art exhibits. But the eclecticism extended beyond the presenters. It was also part of the audience as well. So you might find a hobo sitting next to a housewife, sitting next to somebody from the Gold Coast, sitting next to, like, you know, an alderman. It's a very weird, then next to some college students. It's a very strange audience. All right, next slide. So it was started by this guy here named Jack Jones. Jack Jones was a Wobbly, though he later kind of broke off from the Wobblies. He was also the first husband of Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, who later became a prominent member of the Communist Party in the United States. It's known as the Rebel Girl. He was part of a miners' union out west and severely damaged his hands. The stories always go that he was some sort of saboteur and actually like blew up things in strikes, and that's how he lost his hands, but nobody knows. But he came to Chicago, worked as a house painter, and founded the Dill Pickle Club along with Ben Reitman. Next slide. Here's a sense of the sort of talks that you would see. So this is a talk on the art of sublimating the sex life.
It never performed this talk. They had to sublimate it.
Yeah, that's right. And you can see, right, Professor V. Bruder, M.A., and also, Ben Reitman as well giving a talk, and then Jim Tully, who I told you before was also involved with the Hobo College. So a lot of the same people who were active in the Hobo College were now active in this thing, the Dill Pickle Club, which is reaching out to a much kind of broader audience. Next slide. And here's just a list. It's very dark. I apologize for this. But you can see the sort of plays they put on. So you've got The Long Voyage Home, which is a Eugene O'Neill play. They also performed a lot of Shaw, a lot of Ibsen. The interesting thing is all of the performers were amateurs. I don't want to say that the people who performed were amateurs. Let's just suppose they're not, you know, professionally trained actors who got up here on the stage tonight. There was a lot of people like that, just kind of from the audience or the community, who perform in these plays, including a lot of women of the streets. And Ben Reitman made some hilarious joke about how, like, when, you know, you see a prostitute, you don't want her quoting Ibsen to you. But these women can do it. Also, you can see in there the Doodle Duck, who's kind of the mascot of the Dill Pickle Club. And some people believe that Walt Disney stole the design for Donald Duck from that. But there's not really much evidence. This is one of those Chicago stories.
Disney's from Chicago.
But he is from Chicago, yes. Milwaukee Mike.
I have a question. You'll notice there's two L's on that Dill.
Ah, yes.
One L on
the another controversy of the Dill Pickle Club. All right, so... Jack Jones, who was like the principal founder and produced the stationery and all that stuff, he like uses, kind of like, you know, people use tramp and hobo interchangeably, he uses one or two L's interchangeably. Once again, the apocryphal story is he was worried that somehow the word dill was copyrighted on actual pickles with two L's, so he started using one L so as not to be like sued for copyright infringement. But then sometimes he uses two L's, so who, it's like...
Or the typesetter at the printer might have changed it, thinking it was a typo.
That's true. Yeah, but this is one of his, like, there are engravings that he did, too, that have the two L's, right? I mean, you could...
Or the typesetter was a bomb.
Yeah.
That's true. We don't know. So, you know, the Dill Pickle Club was a space for people from all over Chicago, right? Students at, you know, UC and Northwestern could come to it, or, like, you know... housewives from the Gold Coast could come to it, but there were also ways in which citizens of Chicago could go down to Hobohemia. And you start seeing these tours developing at the same time, right? So, same time that Hobo College was in operation, Ben Reitman would often give tours. And this is a sort of pamphlet from something called the Reconciliation Trips, which were active in Chicago in the 20s through the 40s. And basically, it was this group of people, they were connected to the Methodist Church, and they would give these really long tours on different topics. The whole idea was to produce encounters between different cultures. And it was geared towards college students, but anyone could go on them. They were only 50 cents. And one week, you might go to Chinatown or a Greek town, and the next week, you'd be hanging out with like mystics and psychics. And the week after that, you'd be hanging out with hobos. And the week after that, like with anarchists. So this one is from Crime in Chicago. And you can see how long the program is, right? You know, it starts at 8:30 in the morning, and it goes all the way to 8:15 at night. And it has very much the kind of eclectic spirit of the Hobo College, and that's a mixture of kind of serious lectures given by experts, but you also have things like a play performed at the end. Reitman was also very fond of having meals as part of these tours. He would often give them. And part of the thing with the meals, say if it was like the hobo tour, is you would have to sit down and have dinner with an actual hobo. And you would have to buy his dinner. But then you would get to have like a conversation with him in exchange for it. So in some ways, there was an interesting way in which these tours kind of benefited the sort of communities they were kind of bringing people to. Next slide.
Kind of like the tours from hell.
Called The Pocket Guide to Hell?
Yes.
Why?
All right.
That's true.
A compliment.
Oh, thank you. I thought you were saying it like, you know, the way Reitman is, you know, a little manipulative, but good. So this is a letter I found in the Reitman papers from the wife of Mrs. Harry Dilly, who sold instruments in Gary, Indiana. And Reitman would often get these requests to give these tours of the Hobohemia area. As you can see, Mrs. Dilly wants a tour of the slum district of Chicago. She would like to visit some of the bohemian places and also some of the really slummy places. That's right, and you can see the ways in which like the kind of hobo culture and the sort of bohemian culture are getting kind of like blended and mixed together. What I find also fascinating about this letter is she really wants to have a dinner at Wan Cao's after the tour, so to the Chinese restaurant. So they would go to the really slummy places and then have like sesame chicken at the end of the night. And this was for a women's club interested in like social reform, but you can see how there's still that kind of sensational element involved. And here's Reitman's response. Oh, here's Reitman actually. So this is Reitman later in life, more during the dill pickle era, kind of handing out pamphlets. So you could just kind of get a sense of him later in life. Next slide. And so then he wrote this in response, and so he agreed to kind of give the tour. And so you can see, yeah, he'll be taking Gary women on a sociological tour through Hoboland, Povertyville, and Crooktown. So he created his own kind of regions of Chicago, his own kind of, you know, map. But the interesting thing, too, is that, like, you know, he gets people to come on the tour who have these experiences, and most of his fee goes to kind of paying them. So the Gary women get their experience, but some transient men also get like a meal and then some money for the night. And Reitman was very kind of adamant about this. I know Reitman isn't the subject of this talk, but one really, if you ever go to the, what is now the Hotel Burnham, do people know that?
Yeah.
Downtown State Street? It used to be the Reliance Building, and that's where Ben Reitman had this whole other career as basically a doctor to the poor. He was known as the clap doctor of Chicago, because he specialized in venereal disease. He was the first person to open a venereal disease clinic in the city. And so when the Hotel Burnham was going to move into that building, they were going to gut everything. And Tim Samuelson, who's the sort of architectural historian for the city, fought to have it, he works for cultural affairs, fought to have that building preserved, its features. He didn't win, but the developers allowed him like one room in which they wouldn't change the tile on the floors or any of the window casings or any of that. And without telling them, he picked Ben Reitman's former office as the room to be preserved.
Yeah.
And during the period when the building was abandoned, he left a little light on in that office, because that was the thing. Dr. Reitman would always have his light on every night. So if somebody was drifting into town in Chicago and needed some treatment for the clap or something, they knew that they could come there and get help from him. So, yes, almost last slide. So, you know, in 1929, the Great Depression starts, and that's really kind of the end of a lot of this. The Dill Pickle Club won't survive the early 30s. The reconciliation trips really kind of break down, and the hobo college also disappears. Also, homeless people apparently become heavily pixelated as well. I'm sorry, I really need to find a better image for this. But, you know, the Great Depression changes everything, because suddenly the whole sense of scale is thrown off. You know, whole families being displaced. And hobo culture really kind of changes after this, and gets kind of absorbed into kind of a larger sort of, like, homeless culture, or into migrant laborers. So all you have to do is think about, like, the Grapes of Wrath, and then the Jode family, and in some ways they kind of displace the sort of old hobo. And then by the time you get to the 50s, all you have is this sort of kind of highly romanticized sort of version of the hobo or tramp. And think of, like, On the Road, right? Who are, like, you know, Dean Moriarty in Paradise searching for? Well, old Dean Moriarty, who's the old kind of rail riding hobo in the 30s. So we're going to end with a song, but before we do that, I want to do a little bit of, like, shameless plugging. So thank you all, you're, like, a really wonderful, very, very patient audience. I'm going to say that on Thursday, if you have any interest in the Dill Pickle Club, I'm part of an attempt to revive the Dill Pickle Club. Seth already told you about that. It's going to be at the Hideout. You're going to have to walk through an alley, through an orange door beneath a green light to get in there. But we've got a great lineup of performers, really great people talking about interesting topics. There's also going to be a temporary tattoo artist there, so just in time for Valentine's Day, if you need your mother tattoo. And a St. Valentine's Day masker photo booth as well. And some live music. Kennedy Greenrod's going to be playing, so it's going to be a lot of fun. And then, as Seth told you, I do these walking tours, I do historical reenactments. So on March 6th, if you ever wondered what it's like to be an unemployed person, probably some of you don't wonder, because you actually know what that's like, I'm presuming, given our current moment. I certainly know what it's like to be unemployed. I'm going to be doing a reenactment of the 1915 Hull House Parade of the Unemployed. So James E. Towe, the millionaire hobo, got a bunch of unemployed people together at Hull House in January of 1915. Lucy Parsons, who was the widow of the Haymarket martyr Albert Parsons, was there as well. They spontaneously decided to march to City Hall to ask the city for jobs and food relief, about 1,500 of them. There were undercover cops there. They called ahead. The cops tried to break it up. And some people say it was the first time the very famous labor song, Solidarity Forever, was sung. Was at this event, because Ralph Chaplin was there who wrote the song. So I'm going to be doing a reenactment of that, and you're all invited to come, to tell your friends, to show up in period garb, so dress as your famous, you know, your favorite 19-teens homeless person. There will be Chicago cops on hand, even a couple mounted police on hand as well to break it up. And I have a very wonderful, Alma Washington, who's played Lucy Parsons in the past, reprising her role for this event, and also the wonderful circus band Environmental Encroachment. And then, in May, because this year is the 125th anniversary of Haymarket, I'm going to be attempting to stage with the Illinois Labor History Society a full-scale reenactment, which means I need 175 people to play 1886 Chicago policemen. So if anybody wants to sign up to be a policeman, please talk to me, because I got to start. But you can be anarchist too. But I need alright. We'll show up as anarchists. No, I'll get the cops somewhere else.
Somebody has to be an
anarchist policeman.
Yeah. I know. Right. So this is an image from the Battle of the Halstead. These are two images from the Battle of the Halstead Viaduct, which we did last May, and some of you participated in. And so it was a lot of fun. Cops got hit with fake bricks. You were that's right. And that commemorated something that occurred in 1877. So we're going to end with what is perhaps the most famous hobo song, one of the most controversial, which is the Big Rock Candy Mountain. Many of you probably recognize that song from Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, or perhaps the more recent L.L. Bean ads. Raffi also does it. That's right. That's true. That's true. Raffi also does a very popular version as well. So do you want to... You want to cue the...
Should we do the cheesy one?
Let's do, yeah.
Okay, so can you... Grass?
So this song was actually written in the 1890s, purportedly, by a guy named Harry
McClintock.
What?
Harry McClintock.
By Harry McClintock, a.k.a. Haywire Mac, who was a busker in the streets of Chicago. It had a very different final verse, which I'll tell you about at the end. But we've got a clip. Wait, what's... Do you want to play this?
Is this the one that you want?
Yeah.
Okay.
Wait a minute. Uh-oh. This doesn't look very authentic. Or blowed in the glass, as the hobos would say.
Wait. It's a soda water fountain where the bluebirds sing by the lemonade springs on a big rock candy mountain. On a summer day in the month of May, a burly bum came a-hiking down a shady lane
burly
to the
hurricane.
He was looking for his liking. As he strolled along, he sang a song in the land of milk and honey, where a bum can stay for many a day and he won't need any money.
Oh, all right, okay. So this is actually from the Lawrence Welk show, but it gives you a good sense of the way in which the song has changed over time. Because unbeknownst to the sisters there, and to Lawrence Welk himself, the Lennon sisters, right? The song was originally a song of seduction, right? So it was very common for older male hobos and younger men to kind of pair up on the road, right? At the end of it, it's basically the young hobo telling his older hobo companion that he's not going to travel on the road anymore and be buggered sore like a hobo's whore in the Big Rock Candy Mountain.
Wow.
That version did not make it into what we heard here. But it also did not make it into the version that Harry McClintock, who sang the original version, later recorded in the 20s and that gained popularity in Oh Brother Where Art Thou. Instead, it was also a more sanitized version. And that's what we're going to hear now, and I've passed around song sheets. So if you have a song sheet, please share it with your companion. And to close out the Hobo College, I'd like you guys all to join in. Jamie's going to join us, and back from the great Hobo Beyond, from Lubberland, from the Big Rock Candy Mountain itself, we have the legendary Haywire Mac, who is going to play with us as well. And there it is. Very rare footage of Haywire Mac.
One evening as the sun went down and the old fire was burning, down the track came a hobo hiking, and he said, boys, I'm not turning, I'm headed for a land that's far away, behind the crystal fountains, so come with me, we'll go and see the Big Rock Candy Mountain. In the Big Rock Candy Mountain, there's a land that's fair and bright, where the handguns grow on bushes, and you sleep out every night, where the boxcars all are empty, and the sun shines every day, on the birds and the bees and the cigarette trees, the lemonade springs where the bluebird sings in the Big Rock Candy Mountain.
Follow us on Twitter at YMTE. Friend us on Facebook at facebook.com/youmethemeverybody. And for details on Monday and Tuesday nights at the Hungry Brain, go to youmethemeverybody.com.